of what we were trying to do this morning. We're all human. The human being is a machine for making sense of things, if you see what I mean. As a human being, your mind, it's trying all the time to make sense of the information before it. And what we're trying to do is make sense of a text written in another language, in Sanskrit, 2,000 years ago, in English. It's quite an interesting process in terms of our own very different experience. But fortunately, the text grounds us really quickly. So I hope that this is going to engage you more immediately, because it's immediately going to start pointing at us. So the text begins with these two verses: essence and completeness, difficulty and universal gateway, etc. This is standard for a Buddhist commentary. You start with a verse in Sanskrit, or two verses in Sanskrit, which probably wouldn't win any poetry prizes. They scan, they're metered, but they're just mnemonics, so that anybody trying to remember the text can just quote the short forms of it, as it were, and then you can go back and recount from there. So this basically gives us the structure of the chapter, the nine aspects that he's going to explore. We're only going to explore two of these, and we're only going to explore the second of these in brief, but there's quite a lot even in that. And the rest of this morning we're going to explore the first aspect. Then the text itself comes in. What is ethics for the bodhisattvas? That's what the whole thing is about. Answering that question that I was posing at the end of the morning, of the first part of the morning. In this vast plethora of teachings and all these different possible paths and all these different codes of ethics, how do I, as one who wants to be a bodhisattva, practice? What does ethics mean to me? Whether I'm a monk, a nun, or a layperson, what does it mean to me? That's what the text is trying to answer. Then he gives these nine aspects which are to be pursued. Some of them are dealt with in more or less a sentence later on, and I've never completely worked out what the point of all of them is. But we're going to focus especially on the first two. So, the first is the essence of ethics. Wonderful, isn't it? After all that historical nonsense, what's the essence of the matter? What really is ethics? And his answer is exceptionally interesting, because it really bases ethics in natural experience, if you say what I mean. It says that ethics isn't to do with codes or lists of rules or whatever. It's to do with something you can directly experience. So he says that the essence of ethics consists of four qualities. What are the four? To correctly receive it from someone else, to have a quite purified intention, to make correction after failure, and to avoid failure by generating respect and remaining mindful of that. These are the four aspects of the essence of ethics. It might not immediately connect with you, but maybe we'll get clearer as we go through it. So yes, correctly receiving it from someone else, having a quite purified intention, making correction after failure, and avoiding failure by generating respect and remaining mindful of that. He's saying if you've got these four in place, then you've got ethics. You've got the essence of ethics. So let's start with the one that perhaps doesn't immediately communicate to us: correctly receiving it from someone else. Now, the context he's speaking of, in which he's speaking, is of receiving a code of conduct, if you see what I mean. So, for instance, at ordination into the Triratna Bauda Mahasangha, no, what are we? Triratna Buddhist order. In the private shrine room, private ordination, you recite the precepts, the refuges, and then you recite the precepts after your preceptor. It's in the word preceptor. So the preceptor, as it were, gives you the code of conduct. He gives you the precepts. But what does that really mean? It's not just a question of getting a list passed on to you. Here you are, here's the precepts. It's a question of entering into an ethical relationship so that you stand in relation to your preceptor in a relationship of conscience, of sensitivity, ethical sensitivity. You come into an ethical relationship with them. And that should be everybody's experience quite naturally as you begin to involve yourself with a Buddhist community. You're coming into contact with people who've been practicing longer for you, have deeper understanding than you. They may be not perfect in ethics. They maybe have their failings in ethics. But they are working with ethics as an active practice. So when you come into this ethical relationship with them, your awareness of your relationship with them heightens your awareness of ethics. See what I mean? So that I remember this very clearly when I first encountered Sangharakshita. In a way, I became over aware of ethics, if you see what I mean. I became self-consciously aware of ethics, probably to an extent with a rather false idea of ethics, rather sort of from my early upbringing, my Christian upbringing, a rather over-guilty sort of idea of it. But I became much more aware of, much more sensitive to my own ethics because of my relationship to him. Without him saying anything, yes, he'd led the refuges and precepts in my beginner's class or whatever it was, but I didn't really know what had happened. It was somebody whose ethical conduct I was sensitive to, I was aware of, and whose awareness of me and my behaviour I was aware of. So that's the sort of relationship you come into, one where you're aware of somebody's ethical perspective and of yourself in the light of that ethical perspective. So you know the sort of situation where because you have certain values, you find it, you're aware when people breach those values. If people speak very harshly, for instance, you feel it. You may not say anything, you may be not get reactive or anything like that, but you feel it. That cuss word sort of grates on your nerves, or that harsh way of speaking about somebody else, it just shocks you, it's unpleasant to you. So when you come into contact with somebody with a greater ethical sensitivity than you already have, and you come into this contact with them in a respectful and sensitive way, you become aware of your own conduct, so to speak, in relation to them. It's quite natural. It's not something you have to tell yourself to do. It just happens. Because you've come to the conclusion that this person has, for various reasons, ethical standards, even a spiritual point of view, that you value, you come into a relationship with them which makes you more aware of your own ethical conduct. Of course, when you're dealing with ordinary beings like us lot, that can be quite complex, because you can discover that Subhuti lets fly the occasional expletive when he's always talking against expleting, for instance, if you see what I mean. So that it's not always that you're in relation to somebody who's perfect in ethics. Would that it were so. But you find that the teachers who are around you, the people that you think you could be looking up to, are not as punctilious as you like. But what you should find is that they are aware of ethics and working with ethics and working in the way that we're going to bring out more fully later on. I mean, it's a big mistake if you think when you come in contact with our order, for instance, that you're coming in contact with a bunch of people who are completely perfect. We put on a show of imperfection, of course, just to make you feel at home. But, well, you know. I don't have to tell you. But that's part of the issue, is that you've come into a relationship where ethics are part of your connection. So you can say, why did you do that? You know, I found it unpleasant when you did that. What was going on there? I thought, etc. And sometimes, you know, you'll find that actually you've got a rather false or narrow idea of ethics. And sometimes the other person will have to say, hands up, you're right. But you enter into an ethical connection with others where they hold ethical standards and they have an ethical working practice, and you are sort of in relation to that. It is complex because, as you all know, we bring into our contact with the spiritual community, with the Dhamma, community, our old patterns of relationship, relationships to parents, relationships to teachers, and so forth and so on. And quite a lot of our work is sorting all that out so that we'll be able to separate out our over-idealized or sometimes under-idealized cynical views or whatever. So we have a lot of working out to do. And a correct reception of ethics is where that relationship is clean, where you are in an ethical relationship with somebody else, which is an ethical relationship, not a parent-child relationship, not a fantasy relationship. It's a genuine ethical relationship. To some extent, they hold ethical values more firmly than you do. Not in all respects, not completely, not perfectly, but to some extent they hold them more firmly than you do, and you can enter into that sort of connection with them, which sharpens and heightens your own ethical sensitivity. Because it's very difficult in the course of ordinary life. Of course, it depends on your ordinary life. But many people work in environments, live in environments, where ethics is not much of a priority, and where, probably nowhere are there no ethics. But you may live in an environment which is quite coarse, where people are quite harsh, not got much perspective, not got much idealism. I remember when we were working on the LBC, we had various people selling us second-hand building materials. And after a while, I began to, naive, non-East Ender that I was, that some of the materials that were coming to us were not entirely well gotten. So I remember saying to one of our main suppliers, look, we just don't want to take anything that is stolen. We just can't. It's against our principles. So just don't bring us anything unless you're sure that it's a legal sale you're offering us. And he just looked at me with pity, deep pity. And he said, look, Bootsy, I shouldn't have told you that, should I? But that's what I was referred to by people in the neighbourhood when we were building. Oh, gosh, I shouldn't have told you that. look, Bootsy, you know, get real. It's not hot. It's just a bit tropical. This ethical refinement I'd never really mastered. But, you know, you basically say, look, you can't live without a bit of stealing. And that's the environment for a lot of people in the world, that violence, theft, misconduct, sexual misconduct and so forth, is just normal. You know, sometimes in an extreme way, often in a quite minor way. You know, again, I sort of remember visiting some relatives, and one of them said to me, "God, last night I was completely rat-arsed." It took me a little while to work out what rat-arsed meant. It's not a very attractive image, is it? But, you know, I didn't give the proper response, which was, "Wah-ha-ha!" And he turned on me with contempt and said, "You know, you religious people." So the sort of values around us, you know, it may not be so for you. There are good people in the world, there definitely are, who are not Buddhists, many. But so there are a lot who are not. So when you're in that environment, you're ethically influenced, and it demands a tremendous amount of individuality to stay clear of that. And probably most of you have experiences of this, sliding because of the influences you're under. Because a human being will do almost anything to be accepted. I think it's a deep need within us, which I don't think is attributable to your potty training. I think it's attributable to your evolutionary history. We're pack animals, and we want to be accepted by the pack, by the herd. I derive a lot of my human psychology from watching the monkeys at our retreat centre in India, who behave just like we do. So we have a deep desire, so to speak, to be accepted, so we conform our behaviour, almost without thinking of it, to those that are around us. And what we want to do when we begin to have some sense of a higher life, and especially if we begin to formulate that higher life in terms of, something as lofty as the Bodhisattva ideal, we need to come into relationship with people whose ethical standards we can rely on, at least to some extent, and who we can allow ourselves to become sensitive to, so that we become more sensitive to our own behaviour. I hope you can see what I mean. I think this is a quite natural process. It's not something you have to think. You don't think, he, she are doing that, or I'm doing that, and he or she is watching me, and how would they think? It's not quite like that. Sometimes you can do that. But more often than not, it's just the awareness of them. You become aware, I can't do that. And this is a very important principle that we'll come on to a bit later. But the important thing here is, part of the essence of ethics is coming into this ethical relationship with somebody else, or even with a community of others. In the more formal context, it's an ethical relationship in the context of ordination, for instance. In a way, when you become a mitra, you recite the refuges and precepts. How do you do it now? You recite it after somebody who's leading? Yeah? Different practices. Anyway, you recite it in front of the assembled sangha. So you're sort of receiving it in that context. And at least symbolically, if not in practice, you're sort of entering into an ethical relationship with the mitra and order community around you. So you're receiving it, so to speak, from them, at least in a manner of speaking, to a degree. But when it comes to ordination, you formally receive the 10 precepts from your private preceptor, and then you repeat that before your public preceptor. And that is the correct reception. But the correct reception isn't a ceremonial business. The ceremony represents a real, natural relationship, which should build up quite spontaneously. If you care about ideals, you care about ethics, you come into a relationship with those who care about them too, and who care about them with greater understanding and hopefully greater experience and practice. And that has an effect on you. It's quite interesting. It's not the way we usually think of ethics. We usually think of ethics as a very private matter. That dimension is there, as we'll see in a moment. But in Buddhism, the more private dimension is always paralleled by, complemented by, a public one, a social one. I think it's quite important for us to realise this as, coming from, as probably most of us do, if not all, a postmodern individualist consumer culture where the individual is everything and our own choices are everything. And we don't want to rely on others, although of course we do. We rely on others for fashion and for so on and so forth. But we want to feel that we did it our way, we make our own choices, and so on. And we think of ethics in those terms. It's not the traditional Buddhist way of thinking of it. It's a part of it, but it's only part. Ethics is relational. Ethics is to do with our connection with other people. And if we are to have a truly ethical life, we need to be in relationship with people who hold ethical values with greater experience and depth and even actualization than we do. So that's the first thing. You need to correctly receive ethics from... Is that it? Oh, yeah, from someone else. Those are the words, someone else, another person or other people. So this is part, I think, of what our community is about, what our Triratna Buddhist community and order are about. It's an ethical community where we relate to each other on the basis of ethics. And when we fail in our relationship to each other on the basis of ethics, ethics should be alive enough amongst us for that to come out in various ways we'll talk about in a moment. So that's the correctly receiving it from someone else. Then to have a quite purified intention, quite purified. It's the word that's used is suvishuddha, which is shuddha means pure, vishuddha means very pure, suvishuddha means very, very, very pure. So what it's saying is that you really do have a pure intention. You really do want to live by ideals. You really do want to live a good life. And you want to live it not just for some personal benefit. You know, if those of you who asked for ordination, if you've looked at those guidelines, I think they're still used, the first of those is the request for ordination sincere. We wanted to do that because we wanted, first of all, to acknowledge that even if somebody's not ready, often their request is sincere. But we also want to acknowledge that sometimes it's not completely. It's not suvishuddha, sincere, if you see what I mean. And there are other things mixed up. In India, this is more striking because becoming an order member is more associated with status because it's a traditional society where your place in society is more important. It's less significant probably for most of us here. Unfortunately, being an order member accords you very little status and certainly very little money and power. But in a context like India, being an order member means people, you know, in general society will look up to you. So that can be a motive. We all want to be looked up to. We all want to, sort of have promotion within the group, if you like. So that can be mixed up with it. So if you're going to practice ethics, you need to practice ethics for ethics' sake, not so that you can be, mummy's good little boy or girl or something like that. Often ethics is associated with that, isn't it? Pleasing authority figures in one's life, or in a more heavy-handed a theistic context, pleasing God. I remember that myself, sort of doing bad things and then being horribly ashamed before God. Actually, they weren't bad things at all. They were quite natural and normal, but I'm not going to tell you what they were. You can probably guess. You often, ethics is associated with pleasing big figures or making a good show of yourself, as it were, being respected by others because you're a really good person. But you won't get very far with ethics with that. There needs to be a real desire in you to practice ethics fully and properly. I'd say that this implies something which is not actually stated here, although, yes, it is quite clearly implied, is a degree of natural ethical sensibility. Ethics, as I've already said, is not a matter of learning off sets of rules. It's not a matter of finding out how you should behave and then conforming your behaviour to that. That may be a part of it, because the external behaviour helps you to do something inward. But the ethics is to do with a natural sensitivity. In a way, the word conscience is about as near as we can come to it in English, although that has unfortunate connotations for those who are Christians or from a theistic background. But it's interesting that one of the translations for sati, the Pali word for mindfulness, smriti in Sanskrit and in modern Indian languages, smriti or sati, one of the translations is conscience. In other words, not just an awareness, as it were, like a searchlight, that's there, my foot's there. It's a sensitivity, a natural sensitivity to the world around you, so that you feel a some degree of connection with life around you, and you feel a quite spontaneous, natural, unthought, unconceptualized response when life is harmed or when life is enhanced. So when you see violence, it naturally affects you. You naturally blench. Or when you see somebody doing a kind or good act, you naturally feel a sort of opening of the heart. That purified intention implies this underlying sense of ethical awareness and a desire to draw that ethical awareness out further and further. It's extremely important that we realise that ethics ultimately is natural. And it is drawn out by the fact that all the ethical codes of all the different religions of the world and of many of the non-religions of the world broadly concur on basic ethical issues. Not killing, not stealing, not committing sexual misconduct, not lying, pretty universal through all religions. It sort of implies that ethics somehow comes from us as human beings rather than from us as belonging to a particular culture. For those of you who know anything of philosophy, this is pointed out for the first time, really, by Kant in the Critique of Practical Reason. He looks at one of his arguments for the natural quality of ethics, for its being part of what's brought to experience, is that it's found in all different codes. So that I think is quite important that we realise, and I think Asanga is implying this, that ethics is really in the end to do with this natural sensitivity. This natural sensitivity is either a little bit awake or it's blunted. And a lot of our ethical work is on opening it up. making us more sensitive, so that we're more able to respond ethically. We're more able to naturally and immediately, without the intervention of thought or of any sort of code, we're naturally able to say, this is unskillful, this is skillful. So the purified intention is related to some degree of ethical awakening, some degree of ethical awareness, and a desire to open up more and more. So it's coming from within. The reception is coming from without, but it cannot have any effect unless there's something coming from within. Unless there's a desire to open up ethically from within, the reception from without doesn't get you anywhere. So, yes, here it's put in terms of a quite purified intention. I've taken it a little bit deeper than that. But what it's saying is you really want to develop ethics, and in a way you already know what ethics is. Because if you don't know what ethics is, it's difficult to know how to develop it. There has to be something already a bit alive in you that you're trying to work out. In a more traditional context, people would quite consciously be unashamedly be looking to others for imitation. Again, I notice this in India, where people are much less self-conscious about being different and original. They quite consciously mould themselves on people around them, which is actually the natural thing for human beings to do. We've got this complex postmodern culture where we're hyper-aware of being ourselves. But people would quite naturally just receive the ethics from someone else. They'd want to really develop the ethics, and they'd naturally sort of work with that and purifying their intention further and further and drawing out their ethics, their ethical sensibility more and more. But there's something there already. It's implicit in human consciousness. Ethics is not something added to consciousness. It's something implicit in consciousness, implicit in the mind, that we're trying to awaken, just as aesthetics is, and so on. So to correctly receive it from someone else, to have a quite purified intention, to make correction after failure. Isn't this wonderful? You've got a chance, always got a chance, to try again. You fail. You will fail. You know, you come into relationship with somebody with higher ethical standards than you. You really want to live up to those standards, but you won't. You'll forget. You'll get distracted. You'll get led astray. Old habits will come into play, and back you are, bang, where you were before. That's the way it is. But you make correction. Of course, we'll see more fully what making correction means in a while. But it means you do the things that put as right as you can what you've done wrong. If you don't do that, you put a sort of carapace of insensitivity over what you've done. And at the worst, you can even become sort of cynical about it. You know, sometimes when you're trying to talk with somebody about their unskillful action, I've experienced this and people have experienced it with me too, the first thing you experience is anger. People are annoyed with you for bringing this up, if you see what I mean. Because when you've done something wrong, there's something in you that knows you've done something wrong, and then you try to disguise it from yourself and you defend yourself so that you... when somebody pushes into it, you snap at them, or, you know, mind your own business, or whatever. You don't want to be encroached upon. That's what happens when you don't deal with unskillfulness. Of course, it you know, what you do depends on what you've done. What you do about it depends on what you've done. But if you don't do something, the likelihood is that you'll desensitize yourself, if you see what I mean. So making correction after failure both deals with the practical consequences of what you've done, which is, after all, important. Ethical breaches mean somebody's been harmed. So you need to do something about that if you can. But it also means that you're making yourself more sensitive by saying, I did that. I should not have done that. Confessing it with friends. If possible, apologizing to the person concerned, if there is anybody concerned. And if possible, putting it right. Giving back what you took without asking. Whatever. And also really thinking about how not to do it in the future, but we'll come on to that in a moment. So that you deal with your unethical action. That's part of the essence of action. Isn't it wonderfully practical? We're right out of all this historical stuff. We're just dealing with us and our own ethical sensibility. So yes, the essence of ethics is to deal with it. When you know you've done something wrong because either the person you've received it from helps you to see that, or because your own inner sincerity teaches you've done it, you do something about it. You put it right. It's very interesting that part of the notion of this conscience is that anything you do wrong is actually, it leads to a state which is best translated as a remorse. In Pali, it's avipatisara, in Sanskrit, avipratishara, which is, a state of deep regret. Sometimes it's also kaukrutya, as in, udaccha kaukrutya, udaccha kaukutta. In the hindrances, which of course you all know because you're doing the Mitra study course. The hindrances, one of the hindrances is that pairing. A kalkrutya there actually means consciousness of having done wrong. Can be merely functional doing wrong. You left the gas on or didn't lock the door or forgot your keys or whatever. But most properly it refers to realizing I shouldn't have done that. I shouldn't have done that. And interestingly, it's painful. When you experience shame, a kalkrutya, remorse, regret, it's painful. It's not nice to feel it. But in the Abhidhamma schema, it's considered a positive mental state. It's quite important to realize, just because an experience is painful doesn't mean it's bad. Pari passu, mutatis mutandis, etc. What is experienced as pleasurable isn't necessarily good. So yes, if you've done something wrong, you feel it, and that's painful. So you do something about it. If you don't do something about it, that painful feeling turns sour and becomes embedded, impacted, gains a sort of carapace around it like a wound that prevents you from feeling. So your correction after failure means you felt what you've done. Ow, I wish I hadn't done that. And then you do something about it. Then lastly, what is it? And to avoid failure by generating respect and remaining mindful of that. So generating respect is a very interesting term. It's not actually in the Sanskrit apatrapya or ottapa, which is the way we usually talk about it. It's something else which I haven't yet been able to completely identify. But apatrapya or ottapa is this sensitivity, this ethical sensitivity generated by your contact with others. It's when you have a teacher or a community and you're in contact with them, when you are aware of them, you become more sensitive. Your conscience is more tender. Your capacity for feeling regret is more immediate. It's tuned up. You become much more subtly sensitive to ethical behavior in yourself. So the way in which you prevent yourself from acting unskillfully in the future, the way you prevent yourself from failing in the practice of ethics, is to enter into a deeper ethical relationship with others around you, and especially with a teacher or teachers, and being mindful of that. So this means sangha. Sangha in the full extent and range. So that your relationship to the sangha is an ethical relationship. If you're in a mitra chapter or an order chapter, your relationship to others there is ethical. And you open yourself up to each other in an ethical way. You tell each other about your unskillfulness. And you help each other to face up to that, to deal with it. And as a result of that, you all become much more sensitive, much more attuned to the ethical dimension. You come into a stronger relationship to Kalyanamitras, and if you've been ordained, to your preceptor and your other teachers, so that through them you remain much more conscious of this ethical dimension. I found this in my association with Bhante. It's sort of impossible to forget ethics if you're around him. It's impossible. I, at least, am so conscious of the vastness of his mind and his own sensitivity, especially to unpleasantness in human relations, that it's difficult to sort of not notice one's own mind, the way in which one's slagging people off or belittling people or whatever it is, being rather confessional. But you become much more aware of that because you're in relation to somebody who doesn't do that. So you try to create, through your presence in a spiritual community, a much greater awareness of others and respect for others as sort of better guardians of ethical sensitivity than you are. Again, all sorts of footnotes and caveats, not all the time, not every time, maybe unevenly, let's face it, but you still are able to retain that respect. It's one of the things you have to wrestle with, isn't it? When you realize people you respect have behaved badly, then you have to work out how you can respect them without being unrealistic, if you see what I mean. It's a very delicate and difficult thing to work out, I can say, from both sides of the equation, both from over-respecting people and then being profoundly disappointed and betrayed and, almost sort of spun out from a spiritual community. And on the other hand, having people profoundly disappointed by my behavior, sometimes because it really is not what I should have been doing, sometimes because it's just not what they thought I should have been doing, if you see what I mean. People think that speaking forcefully is not ethical. Actually, sometimes, as we'll find out, speaking forcefully is necessary, as long as there's no hatred involved. But anyway, so it's quite difficult, and it's part of what we're trying to do in building a mature sangha. We're very fortunate at the LBC. There is a quite a mature sangha. It's developed over many decades. I was there at the beginning, and my goodness, we weren't as skillful as things are now. You should have heard the language at the LBC. But over the years, people have been practicing together. We've become more understanding of ourselves, of each other, and a much, much more mature and sensitive ethical environment is there. But it's not perfect. And you will come across things that you don't like. Well, if you want to practice ethics, deal with it. deal with your own dimension of it, and enter into relationship with those who you're disappointed with, and find out what really is at stake, what's really going on. So these are the four aspects of the four essences of ethics. Receiving it correctly from someone else, having a quite purified intention, making correction after failure, and preventing failure in the future by being conscious of respect and remaining mindful of it. So it's not just momentarily thinking, oh, I really admire that person, I really respect that person, but keeping that in your mind. In a way, that's why we have a Buddha image here, because the Buddha is the one from whom all our ethics comes. So we try to remain mindful of the Buddha and to bring our own ethical conduct in relation to the Buddha. But actually, we need living human beings who are doing that, our own teachers and our own more immediate teachers and Kalyanamitras. So we enter into that relationship and keep that in our minds in a realistic but sensitive way. So this is the essence of ethics as Asanga gives it to you. Isn't it a relief after all that theory about the past and so forth? He's just talking about something completely natural and that we all experience. Ethics as a matter of consciousness. Ethics as a sensitivity to behaviour and mental states, and coming into a working relationship with it by taking on ethics from other people and even a community, and bringing that into relationship to our own ethical sensitivity, such as it is, and our own desire to become more ethical, and making a conscious effort to put right what we do wrong. Partly because we've done wrong. And if you've done wrong, somebody's hurt, probably, if only yourself. So you need to do something about it. Don't just leave it. But do something about it, not for its own intrinsic sake, but because in doing something about it, you're dealing with your own mind. You're making your own mind a bit more open, a bit more sensitive. And then use your relationship to people you admire. Admire is too strong a word, but people who you respect is a nice, moderate word, who you feel, yes, they know something I don't. They are something that I'm not yet. Maybe not in every respect, but there's a little bit more from them that I can learn. And keeping that alive, keeping sensitive to it, keeping it in your mind, and working with them in that ethical context. If you do that, ethics will naturally grow. Your own ethical sensitivity will grow more and more and more until it's independent, if you like, where your ethical consciousness is so fully developed that it's maintained whether other people are there or not, whether there are codes of conduct or not. It's just completely natural. The precepts, the codes of conduct, simply that describe the natural behaviour of someone in whom ethical sensitivity is fully developed. In the Buddha, ethical sensitivity is fully developed. He doesn't have to try. In an arahat, fully developed. A stream entrant has it so developed that even if there's a breach, he or she can't let it rest. Without anybody telling them, they immediately feel, I shouldn't do that. They put it right. But you're trying to develop an ethical sensitivity that is fully emerged. But in the course of doing that, your main method is entering into an ethical relationship with teachers and with a community. So I'm going to leave that there. I hope that gives you some food for reflection. And I hope that you can sort of reflect on your own experience in the light of these four. I'm sure you will recognize them because you're here. and you're a human being. So those ethical, natural ethical ingredients you brought with you into this life because you're aware. So these four elements, being aware of these and working with these, will help you to become more and more ethical. We're going to see a little bit more tomorrow morning about these four, but that'll do for now. And I'm giving you a lot, I know, and I know it's too much to take in a single go, but I hope it's given you some sort of guidelines for reflection and future work. Maybe you could even, have some study on all this material later. So we'll leave it there and meet tomorrow morning, 10:30.